We'll start. My name is Tony Giddens, Director of the LSE. It's my great pleasure to welcome everyone here tonight for the second lecture on public architecture sponsored by the Royal Academy and the LSE Cities Programme. I'm asked to announce, if you'll forgive me doing this at the beginning, the two next lectures in the series. I hope Richard will forgive me if I announce these. The second one, the next lecture is by Oriol Bohigas, the city architect for Barcelona, on Thursday, 30 November, and that's called Designing Urban Regeneration. And I mean, he should know a few things about that, because if you read that green book on there, you'll see an interesting comparison between the fate of Manchester and the fate of Barcelona. And everyone here will know Barcelona is generally held out to be the prime example in Europe, really, of successful urban regeneration. The following lecture in this series is by Ed Soger, who is a visiting professor in the LSE Cities Programme, and that's on Wednesday the 6th of December, and that's called Putting Cities First. Well, can I extend a particular welcome to our distinguished guest, Richard Rogers, who everyone here will know, but I'm going to plough through an introduction to him anyway. Richard Rogers, Lord Rogers of Riverside, is of course one of the leading architects in the world. He is the designer of the Pompidou Centre.
Stop.
The Pompidou Centre in Paris, Lloyd's of London, and the beautiful structure. And here I've got in brackets, underlined three times, but not the content of the dome in Greenwich. As well as many other pioneering buildings in London and around the world. He is a member of Ken Livingstone's cabinet and is now the city architect for London. He has been a passionate advocate of cities for many years and has worked hard to put cities on the political and public agenda in the UK. In many ways, his interests reflect the LSE's own academic initiative, the Cities Programme, which links urban design with social science. This is a major area of academic development in the LSE, which looks at the relationship between the physical and the social in the changing global context of cities today. I would just like to say a word about my personal support for this programme, which I regard as a fundamental initiative within the LSE, partly because it continues the central involvement of the city with the development of the social sciences. Ever since Max Weber wrote his classical book on the city, or you consider Paul Wheatley's famous study, The Pivot of the Four Quarters, about the cosmological structure of the Chinese city, and you consider the thing which Weber pointed out, the integral involvement of cities with citizenship, from which the terms, of course, share the same root. The core of the Cities Programme is to show that there is an intimate and massively positive relationship between design, social life, and the personal lifestyle involvements of people as they find their way around urban spaces. And I think it is one of the most exciting developments, really, in the LSE for many years. I'm very happy to lend my strong support to it. Going back to our distinguished guest, who's sitting there looking rather bored with this introduction, I do have to say that Richard has worked closely with Ricky Burdett, who's crucially involved in the Cities Programme, sitting down front row, and Power, of course, who is the co-author of the Green Book on the table. And I think I should mention Richard Sennett, whose ideas have inspired a large amount of the development of this programme. Richard Rogers was responsible for the Urban Task Force, which he was the chairman of, which strongly influenced the white paper published recently by John Prescott. To many, I think including to Richard, judging by the articles I've read by him, this is a kind of turning point in the government's involvement with and support for urban development with regard to part of its wider political program. This is the first public lecture that Richard has given after the white paper publication, so he might say something about what he thinks about it all. The title of this evening's lecture is the same title as the famous green book reposing there. It is Cities for a Small Country. I ask you to welcome Richard Rogers.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Tony. And thank you for many people who helped, and especially, of course, as far as the book is concerned, my co-author, Anne Power. I shall talk about Cities for a Small Planet from a rather specific view, which is, of course, first and foremost, I'm an architect of Richard Rogers, a group of people who have been trying to look at urban design, buildings, and planning. And then from the point of view of someone who's been trying to push the government into taking up the city where 90% of us live and to make it the heart of their policies rather than somewhere in the distance. As Tony says, there has been some success, especially in the last few months, and maybe I'll come back to this during the questions at the end of this. I'll go straight into this talk, though it is primarily from the point of view of an architect who is interested in the morphology of the city, as well as, of course, and that comes out of the social power that morphology or the form of the city comes, which forms the city. Perhaps I'll start the first slide. We've all seen this, I'm sure, if nowhere else in the many books that have been published, which is really the fact that today we have immense knowledge and a network of a constellation of cities. And here you have Europe, and you can see, okay, it's at nighttime, that there's the cities and that the city boundaries are becoming more important than national boundaries. National boundaries have importance. There are policies, after all, but specifically economy is what goes out beyond, and we're coming back towards, or going forwards to, a more city state. And one of the many advantages of a city state is that one can participate that much more than in the larger nation, and the fact that it is easier to comprehend cities and regions than probably nations and regions, and cities and the globe, rather again than nations. Next slide. The city is first and foremost for the meeting of people and the meeting of strangers, friends and strangers. It's for the comfort and the exchange of ideas. It is basically where all culture has come out of. It's in the powerhouse, both economic and social, that cities are created. And that's why in this country, which is probably the third densest country in the world, major country in the world after Bangladesh, it is in this country that we have to be conscious of what we do with our cities because we have very little land. And the two sides of the coin, which is the city and the countryside. So here, Copenhagen, perhaps one of the most civil and humanistic cities in Europe, a city which is more or less equally divided in terms of movement between walking, cycling, public transport, and car. A city where, even though it's colder, it's more Nordic, they have organized and handled the spaces so that you can sit outside. There are blankets issued outside cafes, there are heaters issued outside cafes. The enjoyment is rather like an open car in the 30s. The enjoyment of the meeting of people and the breeze and the cold air in that type of situation. Next. This happens to be the corner next to my offices, which is Hammersmith, the main street, King Street. And you can see there's something wrong. Now, it's not quite fair, I have to say. I have picked the both shots, obviously. But you can see why people don't want to cycle, why they don't want to walk, why they get where they use the car, and the car has become a form of sort of tank, a machine where you don't have to have contact with anybody. Yes, you can run down people, and in fact, as I'm often saying, we've now come to a situation where the acceptable face of death is car accidents. If we have deaths by train or by plane, it's headlines. The fact that we lose 3,500 people deaths on the roads, 300,000 seriously injured. This hardly moves anybody. So how do we civilize? How do we create a civic society? Next. We have this wonderful view of the countryside. We love the countryside, and rightfully so. The problem is that everybody wants to get to the countryside, so we want our motorways so as to get to the countryside, we want to get our houses into the countryside, and of course, that's the erosion of that countryside. And we sprawl out from the compact city, the vital city, the city of intellectual communication, the city of leisure, and we build these little mini boxes, and we destroy the very thing that we want. Next. Now, the brown field, which is what this is an example, is where we're recommending our white paper as chairman of the Urban Task Force, and the white paper now recommends we build on. And we have an immense amount of brown field, whether small sites or large sites. And what we say, and perhaps the most important part of what we say, is the city should be compact, that should be well designed, and that we should use that which we have within our grasp, within our easy grasp. Otherwise, we break up, we fragment the city, and the city becomes a city of sprawl as we go out of that city. Next. These are the principles of sustainable development, that word that's now become the most popular word in our language, and which I believe is of tremendous importance. Probably no single change that I believe in the last 50 years has probably been as important as the concept of sustainability. Long-term thinking rather than short-term. So what we recommend is that the city should be compact and polycentric. In other words, that there should be not only the center, but many centers. That conserves the countryside, it brings vitality, that it should be of mixed uses or diverse activities, live, work, and leisure within easy walking distances or cycling distances, that it should be well connected. Now, connectivity is both... Connectivity is both planning. In other words, you don't have to move. You don't have to go by car. Because if it is well planned, you'll find most. Thank you. This is a trick. No, it's the first it is.
I could keep you entertained while this is going on.
Yes, you do. I think it is on. Okay, let's try. Okay, thank you. I'll get my hands out of my pocket. No fun anymore. Connectivity. You can plan so as to minimize the amount of movement that is needed in cars, so that the community, the neighborhood, becomes the heart. Of course, in traveling terms, we also need an efficient and effective traveling system. Ecological awareness, good design, the whole question about compactness, higher density, can only be resolved by better design. Otherwise, you have obviously city cramming. Economic strength, good governance, and social inclusion. One of the greatest difficulties I think we have all found is to persuade the politicians, to persuade the leaders that there is a direct correlation between social exclusion and physical dereliction. And somehow there's been this tendency always to think, well, if we pour lots of money into one, let's say, health or schools and so on, then that will work. And we're saying, no, if you can't walk to school, if you're living in an area where everybody's trying to get out, it's no good putting money purely in one institution. It's about moving all those institutions together, physical and social, simultaneously. Next. The drivers of an information age, of the post-industrial society, could be said to be the information age itself, which is changing all our work habits, our economic and cultural habits, changing family patterns, 150 years, a worker's life in Manchester. 1841 was about 20 years, expectancy of life in Manchester was about 20 years old. Today, expectancy of life is four times that. In Japan, women, average age in Japan, death is 83. So this has changed the whole social way that we live and work. Instead of having 10 children and a short life, we now have 1.5 children in this country. In the Catholic countries, they have 1.2, which in itself is interesting. And we have got, obviously, high divorce rates, fragmented society, and where we are likely to spend a large part of our life as single people. And of the 4 million dwellings that the government calculated that we will need over the next 20, 25 years, some 80% are single-person households. And that reflects that fragmentation. It's not a good or bad thing. It's a real thing. And it does change, because there is a question, obviously, of whether, if you are a single person, if you don't, and many women now have their first child at 35, therefore they want to live some life before. If you do have 1.2 or 1.5 children, do you really want four bedrooms, a cat and a dog in the country, and live in the countryside with a big garden? But things are changing, and that's reflected in the in that change. And ecological issues, which I'll talk about in a moment. Next. Buildings and transport use 75% of all energy, and they are the greatest polluter. Transport is growing faster, in fact it's nearer 30% now. Industry is less and less, and of course the change from brawn, sort of the steel and the coal and the heavy industries, to brain is also power. The brain is non-polluting, or it should not be polluting, where obviously the whole brawn aspect is by that very nature which brought us great wealth, is very polluting. So how to reduce that, how to create an ecological consciousness within our society is a critical question. Global warming is probably the most worrying thing that we are facing in global terms. And the diagram on your left here, which is about ozone depletion, CO2 production, how to minimize heat loss, how to minimize heat gain, how to maximize free energy. These are all problems which drive the form of cities and buildings and, of course, the way that society acts and reacts. Next. European waste. This is a diagram. What it basically says is that we have we're in a rotten situation in terms of what we do with recycling of waste. We are at the bottom of the league. We recycle less, we landfill most. We really need to improve. We really need to improve our performances. Interestingly enough, Germany and America in this area of recycling, have a much better record than we do. So again, this is just one aspect. We are at the bottom of the league, just about at the bottom of the league. And I have to say, when we come to cities, unfortunately, I think the Urban Task Force came to a conclusion that our cities are way behind the European equivalent, not just Barcelona, but practically all the European cities have been better looked after. And we are probably at least 30 years behind. It was 22 years ago when the last white paper was published by a Labour government. Next. So, ecology, heat, pollution, form our buildings. This is a research project done by our office. And when I say our office, it really means teams, engineers, sociologists, landscape art, and so on, all together. I've been extremely fortunate to work with extremely talented people. But the point that this building does, which is an office building in Japan, it was a project, is to try and achieve more or less zero emissions. And in a sense, this is really the goal. How do you achieve buildings, or for that matter, cars, which get as close as possible to zero emission? And the implication of this is the building itself, the form will change. Now that's the plan of a building just up here. And it's formed by the way that the winds go. it creates a sort of tunnel at the top that's actually, and you'll see that in a moment, this is actually the sort of lift shaft, and you create a wind tunnel, and therefore you can start to generate a wind generator in between those two elements. You can start to have a building which gets the water from deep boreholes down here, so you can cool or heat the building, because the water at this height acts as a medium between the winter and the summer. So you start to use the sun, the wind, the earth, and of course plant and plant life as a way of not using carbon-based fuels. Next. And this was the form of this building, and it had solar cells on the outside. It had basically like windmills all the way up here, which was the generator. It took the water out from the bottom of from the earth, and begins to achieve a highly efficient, about probably 15% energy is being used here, as against the standard 100%. That is difficult, I have to say, but we are certainly working towards it, and it isn't that difficult to achieve 50% efficiency in energy in buildings. Next. But the form changed. This is a building in Berlin, Potsdamer Platz, which is basically an atrium building, where nearly everything has been organized so as to try and minimize the amount of energy. This one probably achieves about 60% saving of energy. It has a big atrium in the middle. The air flows are all calculated. There are sort of shutters, which you can hardly see, but they're yellow shutters. They start to close off the building itself when the sun is coming down, because it's nighttime, it all opens. Next slide. And these are studies of the building and the form of the building in relation to air movement, so that windows can be opened and we can use the temperature outside and the framework of the building and the movement of air, the natural movement of air, to cool the building rather than air condition it. Now, I would say the majority of the buildings within our office are no longer air conditioned. Yes, they do use cool water. They do use systems, and there is some energy used in those systems. But probably the most wasteful of all mechanical systems is air conditioning. Next. In terms of ecology, this is a small town which is being built in Mallorca, part of it. And I'm really putting up here sort of just to talk about for a minute about the effect, not only the importance of urban planning and the form in terms of ecology, but in terms of nature. These are three communities, basically, of sort of 5,000 people each, which we reckon 5,000 people at the reasonable density of about 100 households to the hectare, means that everybody can walk moderately comfortably within 5 minutes to the center. And each center is actually here based around a pool. So these are basically water pools, and the water comes off the hills. And the problem with Mallorca is that it is very dry for 8 months of the year and very wet for the other months, that the water is all lost. And it goes into the sea, thereby you actually have great tankers coming in, not carrying oil, but actually carrying clean water. We have a tremendously overcrowding in the summer and unemployment in the winter. So here we have a small town which looks at the possibility of balancing employment and nature. Next. And this is really the design of this town is based upon the water flow. In other words, collecting the water, using it for farming, therefore employing people during the winter time as well as during the summertime, taking them back out of working in the hotels as the service industry, and at the same time using the scarce water through a series of different pools, from sort of from containers to a formal pool which is actually the heart of the town, all the way down through the mountains, and beginning to collecting the grey water, using the water which falls on the roofs of the buildings, using the water that goes out in the toilets, both as grey water but also for drinking water, because you can do it if you use nature to clear that water. Next. And the same thing, of course, would be for heating. That, in other words, in energy terms, which I'll talk about later, by using CHP, by using local heating places, actually what we're tending to go is from macro, the big sort of the big plants, the big dams, the big statements, going more and more into the microsystems of energy conservation. Now, talking about water, and just this is the last slide on this small town, whereas there were four crops in this area, which were fig, almond, carob, and olive, by having more water, you can start having a whole different vegetation, which used to be there. So the only point I'm saying really is that urban planning cities and so on are not only about the form or the morphology of cities, it's about the way that people are employed, the way that people live, and you can encourage, obviously you can only be, you can only make it possible, shall we say, encourage certain, I can say, retrieval of the past rather in this situation than anything new. Next. In terms of ecology, this is a building, a court building, courts, justice, in Bordeaux. This is the great square in Bordeaux, wonderful cathedral, and on the corner of it is seven courts. You could just, you may just about be able to see them there, and there's a pool in front of them, and these are primarily cooled by water, by earth, by the collecting of cool heat within the mass of the framework of the building. Next. And these are, each one is actually a court. Now the reason for these forms, which are rather like oast houses, if you like, is airflow. There's actually a pool down here. The pool has pipes in it. The air is cooled in those pipes, or heated, depending whether it's winter or summer. The air is then it's brought up here. The air comes through this. These are really big chimneys up here. And of course, at one level, it gives a very interesting forms, apart from the fact that you're using sort of 50% less energy, but it gives you forms which are no longer just box-like, which allows you to more easily fit in that amazing medieval city of Bordeaux, highly fragmented, full of light and shadow, and yet you can functionally, as well as aesthetically, combine in this building a form which allows you to not to create a box. It's also in terms of transparency, it allows the people to move up, and this is a public floor, and the public are invited in. Instead of the courthouse being somewhere which you fear, it's actually something that's transparent, it's something which you dialogue with. Justice becomes part of city life. Next. This is inside one of the courtrooms, and the form of the, and this, there would be seating here normally, just at the bottom here, and you're looking up from the seating. Next. And this shows the schematically the summer and the winter and how it changes. Obviously, the heating and cooling systems and the exhaust and the containment changes in summer or winter. Next, Centre Pompidou. Most of the work that I should be finding in Seigneur, all the work that I've been discussing is primarily related to, apart from the ecological, to the changes in urban framework. Here we see a building changing the environment. Centre Pompidou, Beaubourg, a competition in 1971, which I do with Renzo Piana, with Obabs, Peter Rice. Centre Pompidou, the Beaubourg area, was the slum area of Paris. People now sort of have forgotten it. It isn't Layout. Layout is somewhere over here, which was destroyed a couple of years after we started here. But the point that I'm going to say is that when we came here, it became very evident that this was a very dense area. There was a tremendous need for public space. We created this big piazza. And this area had been cleared as a car park in the 1930s. It had been cleared because this was the center of pimping and prostitution. And there was some idea that if you cleared the buildings, then that would go away. Actually, it proved much more flexible, and it all just, prostitution just moved back one street. But still, it gave us this amazing site. Next. And this was Beaubourg with a great plaza in front of piazza. And the concept of the public domain, in a sense, you know, cities are about, as I said before, public spaces, the spaces between buildings, which excites one probably most in social terms, which doesn't take away from the importance of designing buildings. And this is very much about the public space, which moves all the way up the facade, the escalators, the streets and the air. So the public domain is a continuity. It's no longer just limited to go, like most museums or most libraries, you go through a portal, a front door, you bow, you wash your hands, and you go in. The whole concept is you float through this. You can come in at any time of the day, and you can go to the cinema on the top floor or the restaurant on the top floor, and you have a great view across Paris, and therefore it becomes a sort of a machine for enjoyment as well as a functional thing, which is a library or a music center and so on. And it has tremendous flexibility because nowadays we don't know what's going to happen within those buildings. Change. Is the one constant. So what is today a church may be tomorrow a nightclub. The best nightclub in Paris, the best nightclub in Rome is now in a church. It brings up the question, what is a church? What is a nightclub? So form is no longer what it used to be. It's not something which is set. Buildings are no longer perfect. Nothing can be added to. Nothing can be taken away, that old classical concept. They are actually dynamic, responsive, and must be able to exist with the change of society. Next, so it's a framework. Shanghai, the first of the three major projects I'm going to show you. This is a city for 500,000 people, and this is really a framework which talks about transportation, about, next slide. Hey, okay, there's something out of order here. One moment, I can go back one. This is a graph which basically says the maximum amount of energy is used where there is the least density. There's up here somewhere, I can't read it so close, but here's Phoenix, here's LA, United States type cities. That's where you use something like four times as much energy as the compact equivalent European city, and even more so the Far Eastern city, which is even more compact. And obviously, most of that energy is being used in travel terms. So compactness has a sustainable basis. And so what we need to do is increase density. We need to provide better alternatives to the car. We need to increase restraint on high car speeds and so on. This is all to become ecologically aware, to become sustainable. Next. Shanghai, this amazing and beautiful site, basically a 19th century front with a tributary of the Yangtze River over here, with basically brown, low-density development on this side. Basically, this is a more European on the front. Wanted a city of 500,000 people on this side here. There were practically no bridges at this time, and everybody went around on bicycles, and there were the most amazing traffic jams with bicycles. When we met the mayor, we said, no, it's wonderful you have got 50% of your people are traveling by bicycle. And he turned around and totally misunderstood the point I was making. He said, don't worry, by the year 2000, we'll ban bicycles. But it does sort of tell you something about, again, the image. You have the car because that's part of your image. Next. 500,000 people on this great peninsula, curved peninsula. And the basic concept was a form of the city which went right on, which is actually created in six different towns, all interlinked. And the form is very much given by the peninsula with a great park in the center. Next. This is the plan. This is the great park. This is about a kilometer across. There is a line here of buildings, and there are actually six centers of high density centers. And everybody can get either to the center of the park or to the park along the river and the river within a couple of minutes. So there are the 500,000 people here, and it's mixed use, live, work, leisure. And again, the concept that we were asked to consider and everybody was looking at that point at Canary Wharf. We're looking back now some 10, 12 more years ago. And because Canary Wharf was sort of seen as the big high-tech center. So the concept was, let's have a high-tech center in Shanghai, just offices, and the battle was obviously to try and get it again, live, work, leisure, like a more traditional city. This question of tradition is interesting. I mean, there haven't been big changes. In the Hellenic concept of tradition, there isn't big changes. Yes, there are tremendous drivers, which of course, as we mentioned before, IT and so on, but the basic concept of cities have changed very little over those 5,000 years that cities have existed. And these are communications to the rest of Shanghai, across the water. Next. And this is the transportation plan. Shanghai itself is over here. And what this basically says is the tram linking six town centers, each with 80,000 people or so in those six town centers. This is basically a 10-minute tram trip across from each center. You're moving out from the center, which is all tram driven, to the river. Or to a great park, which is not on this diagram, and the cars come in a tunnel to the center and then spin out underground, car parking, only 2,500 cars for every one of those 80,000 centers, because everything is on a tram line, which is a circular tram line along there. Next. And so this is the sort of interpreted. Here's the great park. The lines are actually transportation lines, which I won't go through, new bridges, new undergrounds and so on. And then a series of town centers along this track, on this tram line, car system are going over here, and then basically bicycles all the way around. Next. Now these buildings are actually organized in points. So if you read these as sort of being the highest point of the building here, and if this is one town, then the lowest goes towards the edges, they're rather like pyramids. But in fact, because they're all on a tram line, there's a street, there's a tram that goes down here, or the light railway in modern jargon, which goes down here. Then whenever you have a high building, which is usually on the inside, then you have a low building in front, thereby always getting view, but equally important, getting maximum light, and 30% of all energy is used for lighting, and also getting wind or air through the building. So you drop the amount of energy needed, you get the maximum view, and what you get is like rather like these things. You get high buildings with low buildings in front. It's rather like this. And you get this maximum amount of energy efficiency and the pleasure of a great view. Next. And so you start to get this form. This is a computer-generated contour map which defines the building envelopes. You can enter any building you like. But this generates the maximum amount of wind and air to drive the efficiency of this project. Next. And then it communicates and connects out with a series of other other centers. Next. Mixed use, this is really a diagram showing the red is on the tram line is where it's mainly shopping and offices. There's the most maximum use on the light railway line, which goes all the way around here. There's also mixed-use housing, and then there's yellow as you get lower density of housing as you go out towards the river. There's the river over here. And if you mix it carefully, you actually use much less energy as well, because, of course, hotels use energy at nighttime, and workplaces use energy in daytime. And you can start to mix not only the amount of energy, in other words, you have the problem with the all-office space. The whole question of zoning obviously has to be deeply questioned nowadays. Zoning comes out of the concept that industry, heavy industry, has to be put outside the city, zoned outside. Then we started to zone both work and leisure. Now I've got tremendous doubts. The whole information technology society is one where you no longer need those zones in most areas. But it can also become highly effective because you no longer have to work that 8-hour day. In other words, you can start to spread the day, you can start to mix live, work, leisure, and you can overlap. And even the amount of car parking and so on can change so that in the zone city, you only use car parking for those very specific periods of 8 hours. But if you have a 24-hour city, then car parking, the same number of cars, is spread out over 24 hours. Streets become smaller. And of course, again, the trams and the light railways and public transport become much more efficient. Next. And so instead of using 212 megawatts, in the normal city for this size city, you can start looking through changes in the form of the buildings to dropping out by a third, and changes in the form of the city by another third. So you get to an energy consciousness of about energy use of about a third to a half what you would in a normal city. You collect the rainwater, you do all those things that I mentioned before in Park Bit, in the Mayorkan town, in Shanghai. Next. It doesn't have to be round. It can be a linear city. It can be any other form you like. These are diagrams, but the basic concept of a city, which is has both a social and energy consciousness, is based upon the social and energy consciousness, is possible. Now, Shanghai has actually built the city. It's nothing like our plan. They still issue a map, which where there's sort of green area in the middle, but there are buildings all the way coming through. And actually, as we were drawing these plans up, they started building most of the buildings in the wrong place. We had immense arguments, not least that the first time they came to us, they said, well, I asked how much of this plan is asphalt, and they said about 40%. And I said, well, even New York is only 16%. And of course, the concept is, and that's the sort of more like the modern concept, which is buildings in space, buildings surrounded by parking, buildings surrounded by roads, which is tremendously wasteful, not only in terms of people usage, but of course, as far as cars, because it has to be car driven. Next. That's the final plan of this. Next. Manchester, the last. An urban regeneration, East Manchester. Now, the good news is, I think, as we know, that people are moving back into the centres of many cities. This has been a general movement lately, and as Tony said, in a sense, the white paper is good news. It should encourage more the use of the moving back to cities. But if we take East Manchester, which is typical of many, many cities, about what, a fifth or a sixth of a major city, the once the capital, the biggest, most important industrial city in the world. Here we have an area where approximately one-fifth of the population of this area is left behind. I mean, they really are left behind. Where 4 out of 5 buildings are either boarded up or destroyed. Where you're, if you have a house, it's likely to be surrounded by 4 houses which are boarded up or empty. Where it's totally fragmented. You can see from this it's totally fragmented. Yet the centre of Manchester is within easy walking distance. The centre of the railway station is within very easy walking distance of this area. So we're not talking far out. Anybody who lives here is trying to get out. All the entrepreneurs which probably would pull the society together are probably like to move back into the centre, which is where the movement tends to be. But these houses go for about £5,000 a house. If you go into the centre, you'd be lucky if you get one for $250,000. It's a lot smaller at that. So if you don't have $250,000 and you don't want to live here, you can only go one way, and that's in the suburban sprawl, back out into the countryside. This is the thing that has to be reversed. And I think this is what the government is beginning to take on. Next. How do you create a community? Here's a typical row of houses where more, okay, that one is, this one, people are living there, but where most of the houses are boarded up. Next. Towns, cities, neighborhoods can be analyzed. A city is made out of community, neighborhoods, districts, city. Those are sort of the pieces that come together in the jigsaw. And what this basically is a transportation network based around a series of nodes, which are transportation nodes, where each one, starting at the smallest, this is a neighborhood. This neighborhood has a density of over 50 dwellings per hectare. Now, in England, we have the lowest density development in Europe, and we can hardly afford it, as I've already said. We have been developing, new developments are going around 23 households to the hectare. To give you a scale of feeling, Georgian London is over 100 households to the hectare, and nobody ever complained of living in a nice Georgian terrace on a leafy avenue. Nobody said, I'm overcrammed in a Georgian terrace. So this question of figures is about the organization, the design, the streetscape, and we could certainly don't need to develop a 23 acres households to the hectare, and in fact, PPG3, which is part of the white paper, does recommend a much higher higher density, not high enough. And if we really achieved the sort of density that I think that I would like to see, we wouldn't have to use any green land. At the moment, the government recommends 60% of all development is on brownfield land. I think we could probably put a lot on brownfield land, except for some very particular situations. So basically, these are a series of neighborhoods which build up into one district. Each neighborhood, as I said, is walking distance to the center, which will have, and because it's compact enough, you can get to your bus, you can get to your corner shop, you can get to your creche, all the things that go into a neighborhood. The things that go into a district is a bigger school, a police station and so on, so you start to get a small town. This is basically a town of 30 or 40 or 50,000 people. And a series of these larger cells, form the city. And the city has the big center, and that has the main railway system, which is just about going through the center. And the bus system goes out here, or the light rail systems. And so you're all starting to interlink. But the critical thing is the neighborhood is within cycling or walking distance to the basic amenities. You don't have out-of-town shopping centers. After all, if you have out-of-town shopping centers, you have to have a car. And anyhow, it only serves the 2/3 of the wealthy part of the society. Next. And the density is at the heart. And all development is, what you're encouraging is, development should start at the heart. Don't start where it's easy to work on the edges. It's easy to work on the green field end. But in fact, it is. There's a hidden cost, both socially and physically in terms of infrastructure. If you're building in the countryside, you're building roads, you're building electricity, gas, and of course you have to have ambulances and buses and so on, which is a hidden cost to the taxpayer. This is Manchester, which is showing you how fragmented it is. This is the center. These are little communities. They're teasing out lights where there are a few lights on. It really is a few lights. I mean, if you think about it, here you have about 5,000 dwellings in this area, which are just beginning to have a few communities. Next. And you start to build it up into that diagram I mentioned, where the city center of Manchester is here, where there's a beginning of a district center, where actually there's Commonwealth Games are up here, so there's a more bigger district, and then the neighborhoods and communities. And you start to build it into a proper a map. It's only a framework. It's not a question of designing the houses, it's a framework. And you start looking at the green field, the green park, and the canals, and the water, and you use the water as a way of encouraging people to live in this sort of city, which historically was a beautiful city, has beautiful buildings, And anyhow, now it has a very much more interesting center than it ever did before. The sad part about Manchester is that it needed a bomb to move into the 21st century. Next. And this basically is the master plan. The master framework, it's hardly a plan, which basically starts to say a canal, the river, so the canal and river coming into the center, pedestrian paths, the park, the centers around here, and linking into the main center here, light railway, which is beginning to come through here. And so you start to knit together the neighborhood, a sort of quilt, in which people hopefully will be able to live without having to feel that they have to escape. Next. The reason that people don't live in cities in my, and I think, first and foremost, is because they're not civil. Cities are so, they're not, they should be. They have every ability. But the city as it is today is a place where many of us escape. Those who are wealthy enough, or those who have certain advantages, universities and so on, live in there. But the point I'm making is, if you could only build the cities and the towns in the way that people could have civilized, lead civilized lives, people would come back. Perhaps the most sort of, as Tony Giddens said, in some ways the sort of example is Barcelona. And Barcelona in the last 15 years has gone through that transformation. We're probably talking about programs of 10 or 15 years. This is a photograph of 15 years ago where there was about 8 kilometers of industrial port in Barcelona, which cut off the town at the back. There's the city right back here. Here's about 2 or 3 kilometers of industry here. Polluted beaches. Nobody could get here. This is this magnificent city with this wonderful grid plan, 19th century grid plan, which couldn't actually get here. And ports, which of course were no longer being used, which this was one of the greatest ports in the world, the greatest port probably on the Mediterranean, which was a complete ruin. Next. This is it today. It has one of the greatest beaches. You can move out of your office or your house straight onto the beach. Great ports, great nightlife, great day life, live, work, leisure, and it plugs into the rest of this great grid system of the city. And so now you have a city where 9 million visitors come to see it. That's nearly the same number as Venice. Barcelona, in its own way, has become nearly a Venice of Europe. And that's within 15 years. Now, it's always been a pretty good city, but it certainly didn't have this until now. It's had 3 wonderful mayors, a great planner in Boigas, who I think is coming to lecture next week, and a series of thinkers, of artists, of creative people, and a tremendous recognition of the importance of creativity and not just management. Here again, we have a little problem in this country. Next. And this is basically it in a greater detail. The beaches, the parks, there's a motorway underneath this, the housing, the shopping, and linking back, which is the most important part. Now, the density of Barcelona, the historic Barcelona, is 400 dwellings to the hectare. Now, I've said our density in this country is 23, the latest density is 23 dwellings. They've got 400 dwellings. Now, the new modern stuff is nearer 200. So it is a bit lower, but it is nearly double what the Georgian is. And yet, okay, they have more light and so on, and yet people are flocking to Barcelona, and it has had some very, I mean, not only is it economically becoming more of a powerhouse, which is what cities are, but in terms of justice and so on, the crime rate is dropping. There is beginning to be created here a civil society. Next. And this is a detail, you know, from your house to your work to your beach. 24-hour city. Next. And more is the last diagram, and this is put here a little bit to sort of to ask some questions. If we look at 1900, where the Beaux-Arts was all about, Beaux-Arts was aesthetic and aesthetics, and the other end was sort of engineering, science, and social, and they never really came together. The idea was that real architecture was aesthetic architecture, and it had a highly formal content, and that social, science, and so on were separated. And theoretically, and this is a theoretical diagram, you could argue that today all three should be coming together. We should be now recognizing that the city is formed as a response to a social society, to a society. And so engineering, right, science, social, and arts all come together, and we move as a team. And in a sense, London School of Economics is. This is where we start to go. Actually, we've been doing the opposite. You could argue that, yes, we did. This was 1900, and there were these three groups, arts, science, and social. And that probably Le Corbusier and Bauhaus who, by the way, were anti-city because the city was so horrific that their concept was to destroy the city, the Plan Voisin, or Frank Lloyd Wright's Broadacre City was about them saying, the city is so terrible that we've got to escape, we've got to either lift it on pilotes and sort of no streets and so on. But having said that, there was a consciousness of a healthy city. So science was coming together once more, unlike the Beaux-Arts period, science together with art. But actually, we've gone worse. You know, I often sort of, I find it rather interesting, a few months ago when I talked to Sir Peter Hall on the Urban Task Force, who is probably the doyen of our plans, and I said, how much three-dimensional architecture do you do? I mean, how do you calculate density if you don't do it three-dimensionally? What's, you know, you just do it mathematically, it doesn't mean anything. It's, you have two stories, three stories, four stories. That's what it's partly about, density. What are the spaces between those? How much urban design do you do in your at the Bartlett's, the doyen of planning schools? And his answer is, we don't. So planners no longer do three-dimensional design. And though I didn't ask Peter Cook at the Bartlett's, but I do go there, I think if I asked him probably how much social education do you give your students, what is the link to society in the terms of social community terms, I think his answer would be the equivalent to Peter's. We don't do that. So we actually have got right back to square one. Basically, art is one end, science is another end, and we need to get them together. Next. Just the last two slides, Rome, Italy, not well known for their organization, now has a system, has organized cities to close once a month on Sundays for traffic. And so you take over the streets, cyclists, prams, and so on. And shoppers like it because, of course, you stop to buy your handkerchief or your newspaper. You don't if you have a car, if you're in a car. You don't even if you're in a bus. But if you're just strolling along, passeggiata, up and down the road, then in that sense, commerce is better. So what was very exciting to see is that cities like Rome are beginning to recapture the space for people, a rebalancing. I'm not saying there should be no cars. I'm saying for a rebalance between people and traffic. Next. And of course, participation, the whole question of bottom-up as well as top-down. Thank you very much.
Just before we start discussion, can I make a couple of apologies? First of all, to the people who couldn't see being behind the lectern. If I'd noticed it, I would have. You can move it, but I'm really sorry about that. Second, apology for the appalling example the LSE is setting for energy conservation, because this room is heated because it's winter. It got so hot we had to put the air conditioning on to cool it down. So it completely contradicts the theme of the lecture. But I think we've got about at least 20 minutes for discussion, if Richard is willing. So I believe there should be, yeah, there's some roving mics both downstairs and upstairs, and I'll leave Richard to pick the people he wants to respond to. Or would you prefer me to pick them?
Yeah, why don't you do it? One second.
Could you wait for the mic to come so that people upstairs can also hear? You have to hold the mic not too close.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Thank you. Would you please give us your definition of a city? What it consists of? Do people need to travel from one city to another to enjoy what they now enjoy? Thank you.
I think traveling is... I think traveling can give great knowledge, great enjoyment, and I would hate to ban traveling. After all, we've been traveling for the last, ever since man came here, mankind came here. So I'm not against traveling. The argument is obviously about how can you be less wasteful? How can you use the resources more efficiently? I don't think if you plan well, then most of the things you can do are, my point is, probably within bicycle. I mean, I cycle mainly around London, and okay, I'm very lucky, I live in the center. Not that London has a center, but if it did have a center, I'm in it. But within six, seven, 8 kilometers, which is about the maximum RSI, you can get nearly everywhere. Now, I'm just using a bicycle at that point. If you want to go further, you should have buses, not every 20 minutes, and then one misses, which is 40 minutes, but one every 2 or 3 minutes. And then, of course, the bus service really would be something. Maybe there's need to be mini buses or yes, I believe in congestion charges. I think we have to find a way in which which the car or the car drivers pay for what is being done both socially and environmentally to our cities. Now, you know, I'm just talking about the car. In terms of what the city is, it's a place of communication for, first of all, social, but also economic. It's a command center for work, leisure, and living, which can be broken down into community scale, where you can minimize the amount of time you spend in lining up in a completely congested street. I'm sure you all know the old figure for London, which is that London, the average travel by car across the center of London is 9 miles per hour, which is exactly the same as a horse and buggy 120 years ago. So there is a question about advance.
A lot more people traveling now.
A lot more people traveling.
Could we have a question from upstairs somewhere? Can you wait till the mic comes round to you, perhaps? It's just can it come from the other side? Oh, do you want to shout?
I try to set forward actually frameworks, but I take your point. I think, well, first of all, I think it is, there is a friction between, obviously, government and public, and a question of top-down or bottom-up. Having said that, the question is, how can you make the most creative, show its creative friction between the two? Clearly, we need to work with the people. I mean, one of the reasons that society is becoming sort of less disillusioned, where it doesn't vote any longer, why there is a sort of feeling of sort of perhaps a lack of civic pride, which is, you know, as we started with this discussion, civic is citizenship, is because the public don't feel engaged. They're alienated. And the only way you're going to get this away from this alienation is a form of much more sophisticated participation than we've had so far. Again, I'm tempted to say we are in the vanguard of this activities. If you go across the water to Holland, you know, where every town has some form of participatory center, and they're usually called architectural centers, but they can be built environment, whatever type of centers, where the people, where the specialists, where government come to meet to discuss the sort of places that people want. We have one architectural foundation here in London, which I happen to chair, and we have one in Manchester. We have a few, but there's so few, and there's no money. Yes, we need centres, and we need centres not just one in London, but we need them in the neighbourhoods. So participation is a critical part, and we need to learn from countries which have done much better, and again I'm going to say Holland, for instance, how they do it. And you don't have to be in Europe. I mean, what Curitiba is doing, even in terms of participation, is rather interesting. It's very interesting, which is in Brazil. Yes?
Is there another question out the side? Then we'll come downstairs again. You could use the mic over there if you would, Q.
You mentioned in the information age we have changing work patterns. Do you think there will be a fundamental change in the nature of physical workspace, traditional office space, in terms of what it looks like, how much we actually need?
Yes, I think there will be. I mean, I think that buildings and cities will change over the next, 100 years in a way that we will hardly recognize. There are certainly a very large amount of buildings already exist, but our work patterns are changing. And of course, you know, I'm sure here, all of you work in at least two places. I mean, you work at home. IT allows us to work at home, and you work probably whether it's in a university or we're in an office. So we're beginning to get that mix, and also in the sense of buying through the television, through the using IT. So the whole of that is changing radically. What we can say, I think, more clearly is the change, that there will be as much change between the rural society of the pre-industrial age, of the rural village, the farm village, as there were between the industrial and the post-industrial time. It may take 200 years, I'm not sure.
There's a question from down the left-hand side.
All right. Thank you very much for your lecture. It was very interesting and intriguing. You mentioned energy as a problem and the use of it. That you said that housing is using 50% of the energy. And I'm assuming here that the problem is the CO2 emissions and hence global warming.
Yeah.
First of all, I mean, current science, this is what the scientists say, is that the direct cause of it? We don't know. And sunspots could be the problem of why we have the high degrees in the atmosphere. Hence, the question becomes, if, you know, we have oil, which is, we know we have it for about 60 to 70 years, and we're still finding in the Caucasus, in Alaska, all of these new areas that we're finding, does it become relevant then to even question whether we should change at all the designs? And moreover, the designs, I mean, people are very conservative. I mean, I'm doing research currently on glass and architecture, and each time I raise that issue, people get very upset. I mean, it's all about privacy.
Why not glass or glass?
What?
Sorry, glass or class?
Glass. No, glass. Not class, glass and architecture. Yes. And
well, thanks.
People are very conservative. So how do you intend to sell these ideas with these designs? Thank you.
Cool.
Well, I think there's already a big change. First of all, I think probably global warming is now sort of accepted by the majority of people who have been studying it. There seems to be a little doubt that the north and south region, northern and southern regions of our globe are melting. This could be spots, but having said that, what is quite clear is that in many cities, there are 8 out of 10 children who are suffering from breathing problems. Now, that is, you know, just out in the street. There are people who are old who are having breathing problems. There is a fear of the city, which is why we rush to the country. One of the reasons is the environmental problems. Of course, there's crime and there are many other problems as well that we deal with. And if we do decide to wait, it seems to me, to decide for the final, until the final moment, that we are totally sure that we're destroying our world, I'd like to know, what are you going to do about it? Are you really going to leave the world when you've suddenly found that actually, yes, the world is being totally is damaged in the most serious way possible? So let's start now, and we are starting now, and I think we have to be conscious that our improvements have been made. I'm not being purely pessimistic. You know, rivers are cleaner. The air is cleaner in many places. There is a little less acid rain in some places. There is a hell of a lot in other places. But we are making headway in a more sustainable society.
There are a couple of people, at least that side. Well, the person with your hand up, maybe. And then I'll ask for someone from down this side for purposes of equity.
You mentioned alienation. Is London, and how would you describe that alienation in London, if there is one?
I think I'm Pa should answer this one. Where's that? the social bit. let's start the other way around. There are very strong reasons why people are leaving cities. And though the center of cities are now being strengthened, and I'm talking about small figures, 10,000, it's a real sigh of relief when we say there are 10,000 more people. I haven't got the figure exactly right, but let's say 10,000 more people now in a city like in the center of Manchester. But we are talking about cities of 500,000 people and more. So the general movement is an exodus from cities. And that has a lot to do with social alienation. Fear is part of that. I often put a diagram, which I think sort of tells it all in a sense in one way, about people, children who go to school accompanied. In 1971, basically 80% of all 7- and 8-year-olds went to school unaccompanied. Today, 10% of those children go to school unaccompanied. Basically, it's fear. Now, fear has a lot to do with alienation. It's fear of the road, fear of pollution, fear of crime, and so on. We are scared of our own city environment.
I take a question down the right-hand side there. Sorry, there are too many people wanting to ask to really, I think, get all the questions in. We've got about another 10 minutes if Richard's prepared to spend that time. There's obviously a lot of people queuing up, though.
Can I take you up on the compact city business? it seems to me that if you regard sustainable cities as just about changing the sort of patterns of consumption and people travelling to the shops and to work, then clearly compact cities are going to be more sustainable. But if you try and change local economies and the economic system so that it saves energy in a much more fundamental way, so that you have food production more local and people's work and other kinds of production much more local, then you're going to have a very different kind of urban form altogether. And isn't the way of saving the cities to make them greener, and doesn't in the end, however much we play with words, mean that's not going to be a compact city at all?
I agree with certainly your first part of the question, and obviously the food production and so on. But actually, the cities which, as far as I know, and this is not my field, but I'm following sort of Girardet, as far as I know, the cities which are more sustainable, and which are many of them in China, which is because they had their allotments and so on around the edges. They also brought them inside, but they still were very dense. I don't know, by the way, I haven't got an answer to your question, but my suspicion is that you can, I'm pretty sure, that you can do the two together. Can I just think, the question of density and compactness is a complicated, it's an emotive one. Anne Power often says, you know, the Cornish village basically is about three times as compact as our average building in England. We are building at 23 dwellings, as I mentioned. The Cornish village is probably about 70 dwellings, and no one's ever objected, now using Cornish village, to the concept of the density of a Cornish village. And if I said, you know, your Georgian town, it's probably about 100 or 125 dwellings. So I'm not at this point suggesting, shall we say, New York, which is 17 times the sort of densities of the low density we're talking about here, or of Barcelona. I'm not saying those are not, but in English terms, in terms of the problems that we're facing specifically here, which are somewhat different in other places, I'm suggesting that we could do a lot better by at least going up the scale to what, 50% more, at least as a start, going from, you know, going to 40 or 50 from where we're, maybe 100% more from where we are now. That would start, and certainly that would stop the point that you're making, which is that we should recognize that the number of calories that you get from eating an avocado, the amount of energy you get out from eating an avocado, is nothing to compare with the amount of energy used to getting the avocado to your plate. So I'm just using it as so there's a whole question of where food comes from and growing it, whether you grow it in your own garden where it tastes a lot better, and whether it's seasonal, and whether it's in the fridge, and so on.
Can I take one from upstairs? Take one from upstairs, the back there, maybe. Thank you. Can you speak up?
Hello? I wondered in how far the discipline of medicine and counseling are included in your course of architecture. I know you said that is in terms of building and building materials.
Medicine?
So I didn't hear
it. It wasn't on, I'm afraid.
Can you either shout or switch?
Isn't
you got the flask
okay.
Better.
Right. Yeah. I wondered in how far you take the disciplines of medicine and health policy into consideration in terms of building materials and generally?
Well, it should be. The question of how much. Clearly, much of the discussion about materials is, you know, what you do after you've used them. In other words, what you do with the waste. And now we're becoming much more conscious of this in terms of, you know, the idea is to recycle as much as 70%, whether it's a car or whether it's a building. And one should be looking at that type of those sort of materials. We have it in one of the early diagrams. We have a serious waste problem. In terms of health, yes, again, there are lots of regulations. I'm sure they're not good enough, and I'm sure that we're not following enough, and we should be ahead of the regulations anyhow. We should always be in advance of those regulations, which are made as a sort of as an average. The point you're making is, are we conscious? We try, but I'm sure we're not enough.
There was someone in the middle there who was going to... Well, there's so many people. Too many people want to ask questions.
You talked about idealized cities, but what is the reality? And what is the political solution? Because long time ago, a city of 10 million was unheard of. And especially when you look at the developing world, you find umpteen cities now. And I don't have to mention, especially to you, Mexico City with 20 million. And even in the United States, there is talk now about Palm Beach. Well, I think of Palm Beach in other terms. You look at the map of Florida, and it's 100 miles of build-up area. Now, what are you going to do politically to prevent this absolutely disastrous growth?
I think, yeah, again, one has to sort of, one has to but accept that there are cities which are out of control. I suspect part of that, of course, is poverty. I mean, we haven't, I don't want to start another, how many people, 500 people discussing poverty in the city, which is a highly critical problem, in which case I'll hand it over to Anne if we do, to start discussing that. But, you know, Tokyo, in its reality, if you take, is actually a city of nearly the same size. We're back to sort of that 19 million. Mexico City is a bit better. One of the points that we're making is, and I haven't made a statement about, and I don't really want to because I wouldn't know how to do it, about an optimum size. In fact, what we're talking about is directions. In fact, I think it was a misunderstanding. The plans I show are directions. They're not meant to be how you will live. And as far as the directions are concerned, we're saying even if there are big cities, you can still create the basic element that is still the community. And communities form neighborhoods, and neighborhoods form, and that you can still break it down to make it more handleable. And there are things like, you know, green areas, and which should be connected up and formed so that you're not so conscious. I mean, London, after all, is a pretty big city. Its wealth, in a way, is that it has a lot of, in the better areas, the richer areas, not the answer, it has a lot of green areas. In the best Georgian, I mean, the reason that people tend to like living in your, and I keep on coming back into the Georgian, in the Georgian town, is because they're built around squares. They're built around avenues with trees on. They absorb the CO2 nowadays, but actually what they are, they're beautiful, cool, and the houses are wonderfully flexible and so on. So I think you can probably live in pretty big cities. I don't know what the limitation, if the amenities are there. The problem with cities in South America or in India is that they don't, that even the small ones there, I don't know whether it's better, it probably is better to be in a small one, I wouldn't know. But the lack of amenities in the city is more serious to me than the size, but I'm not an expert.
Does someone from this side want to ask something? Well, down the front, that's a neglected area, the front, where all the privileged people sit.
Richard, having just come back from Hong Kong and where the chairman of the Kowloon Canton Railway, when I asked him how many accidents they'd had in the last year, said they'd had two serious accidents. And I said, what were the consequences of those two? And he said, they both resulted in 20-minute delays. And they had six less serious ones, which resulted in 10-minute delays. And it seems to me we have a city structure, the expectation, for instance, suburbia was generated through the railway system, metro land being the... We then exported that to America and Australia and everywhere else. And it seems to me that the future of the planet is really in the hands of the English-speaking world. Because the English-speaking world, if you take your graph with Houston at the top coming down, is actually probably accounting for 80 or 90% of the world's CO2 emissions. The real question in terms of this country is, what is obvious is that in our former colonies, which used to be quite humorous places or didn't exist at all, like Singapore 40 years ago, at the time when we started axing the railway system under beaching, they actually were created as countries. They now have systems which make ours look a joke. And it seems to me that a lot of it isn't to do with design, it's to do with administrative capability and management. Now, you touched on it, but we have, is there any move in government to tackle the political and administrative abilities of the country without which you really, in a sense, are struggling against huge odds?
I think I see just two questions. I think that the developed world, which is really, as we know, uses over 75% of all energy and pollutes freely and happily, unfortunately, and it's not. And the third world haven't got the means, and therefore don't pollute so much. In terms of coming back a little bit to the white paper and the government movements in the last. Few months, to including the transport policy, which is certainly part of what gives us a hope, because it's the beginning of an investment. I
it's a reversal of the beaching strategy. I think that the government does realize. I mean, one of the exciting things, back to the sort of global view and certainly the European view, is that you only have to look, as you've done just now, not that far away, certainly from that, you know, from that satellite. We know what they're doing in Hong Kong or Singapore and so on. And we say, God, they're doing better than we are. They have got congestion charges in Singapore. Maybe they're a pound, whatever it is. I think they're very low. But it does control that 10 or 20% of that transport, that much less. You can invest it in your public transport. And we are beginning to, London is talking about it. I think the fact that that England is becoming much more regionalized or city-based allows us to do different experiments in different cities, which we have to, because we don't know the answers. But what we shouldn't be is purely centralized. I mean, you know, Manchester or Hull or whatever it may be should be doing something different. And then that way we can start to measure which is more successful. Obviously, we have to have a national framework. That goes without saying. And every time I'm in Japan and I watch every 2 minutes from Tokyo, you know, a train going right from to the tip of the north and at the same time right to the tip of the south, is practically a moving carpet of trains, of beautifully working trains. And you realize they didn't have any of the beaching problems and they really have a system. If you go to the reverse, America practically doesn't have railways. So obviously someone lacked vision. It's actually not management. Someone lacked vision.
Well, we just got time for one more question, I think. Does anyone have an overpowering need to ask it?
Great.
I'll pick right up the back there for the conclusion. If you could speak up so that people upstairs could help, it would be very good. Since this is the climax of the evening now approaching.
Hello?
All right.
Yeah, you're there.
What is your personal opinion as to what you would do with people's need for independent travel within cities?
Give them bicycles, no.
automate.
I mean,
for automated travel.
Well, no.
You want to move them around?
My point is not to say ban the car. I'm saying a rebalancing of the situation to try and control the situation. You know, a 25% cut would be already something. I mean, one of the problems about the car is that most used of cars, our trips are traveling under 4 miles or 6 kilometers, which is certainly within bicycle range. And a lot of that is within 1 mile, which is within walking. But it's so unpleasant to cycle. It's so unpleasant to walk that nobody does it. It becomes a cultural thing. In Germany, 10% of people cycle. In Copenhagen, it's about nearly a quarter of the people cycle. In Shanghai, it's nearly 50%. In England, it's 2% cycle. It's not climate. It's cultural because it's so horrible. Sorry.
Just before everybody goes, could I say there's a reception on the fifth floor, which is available through the lifts or for the ecologically conscious up the stairs, the fifth floor of the old building, and everyone is welcome to attend. So thanks. Can I thank Richard again very much? Thank you.